and move this to the side. Is that right, Tash?
Red light on the top?
Red light's going, yep, here we are. Right. Well, thank you all for coming. It's for me it's a pleasure to sort of come to Nottingham and also be involved in the talk earlier today at Nottingham at the university. Can I just see from a quick show of hands, does anybody here until perhaps very recently still think that biofuels were positive? I mean, you may have only just woken up to it, but anybody think that it was actually a good idea? Okay, that's great. So a few people still think it was a pretty positive thing. So the PR job done by large corporations has been pretty successful, and that's what we tend to find wherever. Biofuel Watch is a very small NGO. It's just four of us who work as volunteers pretty much full-time, trying to write and publish and do media work and lobby government and the EU. And now, latterly, this is my first sort of start of this process, is get involved in grassroots activism. And we feel that if we don't do that, we will actually not be able to muster enough influence in order to bring a halt to what is now as big a challenge to climate, if not bigger, than fossil fuel emissions are. And we know that the debate has raged for at least 15 years on fossil fuel emissions and how we've got to reduce them down. We now have a pretty hopeless protocol that we call Kyoto, which is designed almost certainly to send us right over into oblivion. But at least it's there, and at least people are talking about fossil fuels. What they're not talking about is the other aspect of climate change. If we are to stabilize climate, we need intact ecosystems, and particularly ecosystems that drive and maintain stability of the climate. There are two that come to mind that are central. One is the Amazon rainforest, which drives the rainfall throughout the northern hemisphere. The other is the Southeast Asian peatlands. Not only are they major repositories of carbon, but they also have a climate stabilizing influence as well. We could go further and we could talk about the marine ecosystems and just what a massive influence they make on climate. But for the moment, I just like to keep it onto the terrestrial side of things, which is really where biofuels comes in. So you can see here that there are four broad areas. It has impact on climate, biodiversity, in other words, the diversity of living things on planet Earth, communities, and I mean by that human communities, and also food availability on the planet. So I'm going to talk about those broad areas. I'm very happy to take questions, but I'll leave it up to you. If you have a burning question, do feel free to ask. Otherwise, we can sort of look at it at the end. So this is a picture of a protest that happened in Mexico at the end of January this year. Around 75,000 people took to the streets. The Latins are very good at this. When they're upset about something, the world knows about it. Unfortunately, we don't have that culture, and people are quite happy to sit in their armchairs and watch the latest soap and complain about it, or complain about it down the pub. And that's a very serious disadvantage we've got, because it means we're not potent as an influence and as a force. And also, we've lost faith in our capacity to influence people. The Latins haven't done that. They will get families and relations, and they'll make a stigma out of not going. So here we have a strong protest by the Mexicans about the increasing price of corn, their basic staple of tortillas. And Saab are one of the main automobile companies that are driving, and or at least publicizing, that they are running their vehicles, or designing all their vehicles to run on a high proportion of bioenergy, in this form bioethanol or biodiesel. There are two broad forces that are driving the biofuels agenda. The second one is the one you'll probably be familiar with, the idea that it has some kind of mitigating influence on climate. Well, that's a big misnomer. I'll talk a little later about life cycle studies, but the life cycle is really the from the production of the feedstock, the crop that will ultimately be turned into biofuel, right down to the burning of that biofuel in the tank of a car. They look at the amount of carbon that's actually emitted in that process. And studies done quite recently show that for maize, for example, if you count in the fertilizers from nitrogen fertilizers, the nitrous oxide given out, and nitrous oxide is 310 times more powerful than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. So it's really important to calculate it in. And they find that actually it produces 50% more emissions from growing maize than you would from burning the equivalent proportion of petrol. Burning maize, when I say that, I mean the bioethanol that's produced from maize. So even if you take the full life cycle into account in terms of the growing, that's the number of tractor runs, the amount of pesticides and fertilizers and herbicides put on the land, the transportation to the refinery, the processing in the refinery, then the transportation to the petrol pump, and then the burning in your vehicle, you produce 50% more emissions than petrol or diesel from fossil fuels. So it's a complete misnomer that it is good for climate. Now, what I haven't taken into account is I haven't taken into account the macro picture, because virtually all biofuels have an impact on land and land availability. And if you think about it, where is this land coming from? It's got to come from one of two places. Either it'll come from agricultural land, in which case you will have less food production, or it'll have to come from virgin ecosystem, whether it be forests or whether it be grasslands, all of which contain very high amounts of carbon when they're in their intact state. As soon as you plow up something that doesn't seem to have a lot of biomass, like meadows, enormous amounts of carbon get given off in the soil, far more than could ever be saved. As I've shown you, they're not saved, but historically they used to think that burning biofuels could produce a little bit less greenhouse gases. So you'll be familiar with that, the idea that in order to meet our targets with the Kyoto Protocol, we might achieve some benefit from biofuels. The second area you might be less aware of is oil depletion and the idea of peak oil. And peak oil, very simply put, is when our requirement for oil, our demand for oil, exceeds the production of oil. Now, we're about level at the moment. We certainly haven't gone into extra requirements. But it may well be that we've got a reduced oil supply. And certainly our discovery of reserves of oil is much more reduced. There's almost no or very little new discovery of oil at the moment. Now, this worries almost all nations, particularly developed nations, because it means that if we tip into a point where our demand exceeds production, we suddenly end up with economic freefall. And by that I mean that we will be losing oil availability to the tune of 1% to 2% per year, ongoingly, year after year after year. And in an economy globally that's built on oil, that's bad news. So what has been happening behind the scenes is governments have been getting together and they've looked at the poster child of Brazil, if you like, that's done very, very well in the last 15 to 20 years on producing bioethanol by growing sugar beet and sugar cane on their land, and realized that actually there is not only money to be made out of this, but we can also create a stopgap between from the deficiencies that we might incur if we cross a point of peak oil, and make it up by perhaps 2, 3, 4, 5%, maybe 10 or 20% of biofuels, or so it seems. So this is a secondary hidden agenda. Some people think that it's a secondary agenda. I think the reality is it's much more likely to be a primary agenda. The economy probably comes first when it comes to global economic activities. And then we have at the bottom, I said, one dysfunctional paradigm that we're living in now. And this dysfunctional paradigm is quite simply that we believe that economic growth is essential to have the sort of lifestyle that we have today, despite the fact that it causes untold misery, untold devastation, ecologically speaking. I was saying earlier on this afternoon that there's a quote from a guy called Herman Daly who says that if you really think we can have infinite economic growth on a finite planet, you're either a madman or an economist. I suspect that people choose not to wake up to that point of view because it's not in their interest, even though they can see the writing on the wall there. Well, this just summarizes what I just said about peak oil. The green histogram shows at the discovery of oil, and as you see, towards 2010, there's very little new being discovered. And the black line is the production. And the production's hitting is about stable now, and demand is still increasing, so soon the curves will cross. How many of you have seen something like this before? It's called the hockey stick curve, Mike Mann. A few of you seen that? That's great. Good. Well, I'm not going to go into it too much detail because I understand most of you know a bit about climate. But essentially speaking, we've been oscillating between cold periods at the bottom, and if you look at the left-hand side on the left-hand axis, you've got the carbon dioxide concentrations. At the very base, they're at about 190 parts per million of CO2. And the warmer periods, which is higher up here, which is about 280 parts per million of CO2. And we've been oscillating between 190 and 280 for about the last million years that we know of. Ice core data now goes back to about a million years. And what's happened, and we know this up to 850,000 years, is that planet Earth has been oscillating between these warm periods, which we call interglacials, and these cold periods, which of course are glacial periods. And roughly speaking, the glacial periods last between 90,000 years and 100,000 years, roughly speaking. So very long periods of icy cold conditions before, as a result of a wobble in the Earth known as the Milankovitch wobble, after the person who discovered it, it seems to happen roughly every 100,000 years, and it kicks us into a warm period of around 280 parts per million of CO2. And we stay in those warm periods not for very long, maybe 10 to 12,000 years, and then another 90 to 100 in a cold period. Now, we're at the end of an interglacial right now. We've been in this relatively warm period for about 12,500 years. And had we not fiddled around with the thermostat of the planet, so to speak, we would be in the next, whatever, few hundred years heading towards an ice age. Now, you might think, thank God we're not going for an ice age, but actually planet Earth likes it cool. Most of our biodiversity on Earth is capable of supporting or surviving to some degree, a reasonable degree, through an ice age, because of course it's evolved through an ice age. And if we were human beings living in a temperate zone like now, and we were heading towards an ice age where we were about to be covered with a mile of ice within a few hundred years, we would simply retreat further south, and then we'd migrate north again, as we would have historically done. Now, climatologists are very worried about this, as you can imagine, because we're no longer within this envelope between 190 and 280. What we've done is we've bolted out of that, the yellow line, towards much higher degrees of carbon dioxide emission. And the yellow line begins around 1750, at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And now we're up to about 383 parts per million of CO2, and we're about between 0.6 and 0.8 degrees warmer today, probably around 0.7 degrees. Now, climatologists worry about this for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons is that our genetics are not built for this. Modern man in the current form we're in, we've only been on Earth in this modern form for about 500,000 years, which takes us to about here. We go much further back, and we're talking about common ancestor type period. So our genetics are all to do with living within this envelope between 180 and 290. The other reason they're worried is that the very high temperatures, particularly the sudden acceleration of CO2, is only mimicked when they look back through historical paleontological evidence, is only mirrored in the previous mass extinctions. And there's one mass extinction that shows this very clearly and almost perfectly describes the vertical ascent at the end. And that's the one at the end Permian period, about 250 million years ago, when something like 98% of all species died off on the planet. Now, there have been many, many extinctions on planet Earth, but there have only been five mass extinctions where virtually everything was wiped out. And it's suggested now that if we're unable to control climate, the number of feedbacks, particularly the positive feedbacks that accelerate climate change, will make sure that we don't just rise by a degree or two, we could be rising by 8 or 10 degrees centigrade. And if that happens, we will be kicking in the sixth mass extinction of life on Earth. Some people say it's already begun. The question is, can we wake up in terms of our consciousness, and can we utilize the skills and scientific technology that we've got to actually redress this and change that vertical ascent of CO2? So that's a very rough look at what we're doing and why the world, particularly the developed world, is waking up to carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases as well that are contributing to this problem. So what everybody knows about is that it's primarily driven by greenhouse gas emissions, of which the primary contributor is CO2. We contribute about just under 8 gigatons. A gigaton is 1,000 million tons, or 8 billion, 1,000 million tons, so 8 billion tons. of CO2 from fossil fuel burning. We also contribute another 3 or so gigatons, or a little bit more, from biological carbon, which is the destruction of ecosystems. When you burn forests, that carbon goes into the atmosphere and is described as biological carbon. So we have here something like 10 to 12 gigatons being emitted every year. Now, in terms of our ecosystems are only really able to absorb, those figures are actually modern figures, and I haven't updated what I'm going to show you in a minute, so I'll read that as about 10 gigatons. And we absorb something like the biosphere, the ecosystems on the planet and also the oceans, absorb about half of what we emit. Now that's quite important to recognize that, because common sense would tell you that if we wanted to stop increasing the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, the very least we should be doing is halving our emissions. Is that fair to say? And then if we halve our emissions, we know the other half is already being picked up in ecosystems. Now it wouldn't last forever that way, because ecosystems themselves are starting to break down as a result of increasing CO2 in the atmosphere. But at least we'd be in a temporary position of holding things, keeping things on hold. There are three major Earth changes that we probably need to keep our eye on. Well, we certainly need to keep our eye on. One is Arctic ice melt. We've seen massive change in ice melt. It's been reducing now by about, on average, 100,000 square kilometres a year just throughout the last two decades, until about 3 years ago. And 3 years ago, it moved from that very gentle increase, about 100,000 kilometers, square kilometers a year, and suddenly it's gone up into a vertical ascent. And this last year, this current year, 2007, and it's particularly the summertime melt that they count. The summertime melt and the amount that refreezes in winter, it's the difference between the two. We have now, this year has been 1 million square kilometers. So it's suddenly gone up tenfold. So what you can tell from this is, instead of going through that linear phase of gentle degradation, which is what we traditionally see as climate, it's now moved into an exponential phase, which is why we use the term catastrophic or abrupt climate change. Abrupt meaning it's suddenly changed direction. So now we're losing, as of 2007, 1 million square kilometres of Arctic ice per year, and that's going to go on increasing, sadly. And it's going to go on increasing not just because of we're emitting more CO2 into the atmosphere, but also because the positive feedbacks in the system are gaining momentum. So we need to keep our eye on that. There's not a lot we can do about that. We've crossed the tipping point of Arctic decline. If I'd had this talk with you 5 years ago or 6 years ago, we would have said that the Arctic was going to be completely melted by something like 2140, 2130, something like that. Now they think it'll be gone by 2040. So the whole thing has come forward by 100 years. Expect that to be the case with almost every other tipping point there is, and there's something like 8 to 10 of them that are serious. So there's a desperate need to catch this before it gets into the exponential phase, because there's nothing you can do about it at that point. The second area we need to keep our eye on is the Siberian permafrost and the melting of the permafrost is solid ice, ice that stays intact throughout the 12 months of the year. Now the melting of when you have ice intact like that, the methane underneath it, which is heavily compressed and under a lot of pressure, stays intact and stays under the ice. As the ice starts to melt, the methane bubbles out. Now methane's about 23 times as powerful as CO2 as a greenhouse gas. So again, it's pretty hefty stuff if that starts to get out in large volumes. So the Siberian permafrost, as far as we know, is still emitting methane on a linear way. In other words, the ice is melting linearly. But of course, you can imagine what's going to happen. Sooner or later, that's going to move to an exponential phase as well. And again, that's why they use the term tipping point. And sadly, if the Siberian permafrost gets into that phase and the planet does warm further, we could well see the Arctic permafrost melting, the Canadian permafrost melting, the Scandinavian permafrost melting. So this sends off a chain reaction on a number of other areas that all accelerate the warming in the atmosphere. So carbon emissions and other greenhouse gases, which I won't go into right now, but that means everything. It determines whether or not we're able to stabilize climate at all. I think the bottom line is self-explanatory, but just before that, the third area to look at is the Amazon. I describe the Amazon as almost like it's like a hinge ecosystem. Everything hinges on this. If the Amazon goes into collapse, and we've had two consecutive years of drought, this year it's been broken temporarily, but now at the latter end of the season the droughts have returned. The Amazon's really only designed for a year of drought. In an El Nino year, the Amazon can survive a year of drought. But it's not, you never get two El Nino years. So it's not designed for 2 years of drought, and we're virtually into 3 years of consecutive drought. If this carries on, and there's some very good reasons why it's happening, principally because of deforestation, if it carries on, what will happen is that the autumn fires, it may not go out. Now, I don't know what they are this year, but this is a time when they're blazing brightest. But last year, there was something like 70,000 fires picked up on satellite photography at one point in time in late September. So you can get an idea of just how much of the Amazon is ablaze. And this year, what I have seen on the satellite photography is that Paraguay and Uruguay and eastern Bolivia are all ablaze as well. The fires are raging through those countries that normally aren't affected by fire. We should be on red alert, emergency alert globally now. That's the situation. Even though our lives for you and I are relatively similar, you can still buy fuel at roughly the same cost, you can still fill up your groceries and everything else, but actually we're in a state of emergency. And if we had any sense on planet Earth, that would be what would be on the front page of the news and what we could do about it. Because the earlier we prepare, not only the more likely we have to stabilize climate, but the easier it is to make the transition to a different kind of lifestyle that will be inevitable. So the Amazon is a third area to keep our eyes on, and that takes me straight into the biofuels agenda. Because clearly, land space from the tropic is one of the most productive lands on the planet, and is ideal for growing biofuels, which can produce the fuel that governments are wanting to get hold of for the reasons of peak oil and climate change that we talked about earlier. But as I also talked about earlier, the climate change scenario is a misnomer, and it doesn't contribute to climate change, to benefits of climate change at all. So this is a picture of the Arctic receding. 1979 is the outline of the red, and 2003 is the white ice. Now that has moved quite significantly since 2003, because that was roughly about 2004 was when we moved into exponential decline, so that'll be quite a lot smaller now. And of course there are many casualties of this, sadly, polar bears. This is taken from the front cover of New Scientist from a couple of months back. They can swim about 60 kilometers before exhaustion sets in. So essentially, when their icebergs melt, they have to be able to find something within 60 kilometers. Without icebergs, they can't feed. So outside of zoos, we could easily see the extinction of polar bears. And of course, the gene pool is so small in zoos or those kinds of environments that you wouldn't have a viable breeding population anyway. This is the Siberian permafrost here, just to show you what happens as the ice melts, and all this photosynthetic activity happening on the right-hand picture, a very great cause for alarm. Not only is it dark and therefore absorbing more light instead of reflecting it back, but it's indicative of the amount of methane that's getting through, because you would not get that kind of photosynthetic activity on ice. So clearly it's melted. Okay, so our wake-up call here, we've had them for at least the last 15 years. In fact, you can even go back further to 20 years. Do you remember 1987? Mm-hmm. Not all of you. Yeah, the great hurricane of 1987? Yeah, and let's see what happens. I mean, we're seeing this is happening in the US, and we're seeing more frequent hurricanes there every year. New Orleans, as you know, devastated as the levees broke, and this was all very predictable, and things sadly will get worse. And in our economic driven world, we are ensuring that we don't put a stop to this. And this is why I'm really here, because our lobbying at the EU level and at the UK level has not really producing the sort of results. So we can get a few people to listen to us, we're getting a lot of stuff published, but it's almost meaningless in terms of what governments are absolutely determined to do. And I'll talk about that a little bit more later. This is one of the responses that the UN have come up with under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Two researchers, Pascal and Sokolo, came up with this idea that we have a number of different technologies that can reduce carbon emissions. And they've come up with, in fact, 14 wedges, of which the UNFCCC have used seven. So the International Panel on Climate Change has drawn up this proposal for stabilizing greenhouse gas emissions over the next 50 years. And each of those wedges saves about 25 billion tons of CO2, and biofuels is one of those wedges, one of those seven wedges here. Now, the interesting thing about this is, and when this was drawn up, and this is just looking at fossil fuel emissions, we've got 7 gigatons of emissions. Now, I know I told you earlier it was nearly 8. So just looking at the 7 for the moment, 7 gigatons of fossil fuel emissions. And if I tell you that we know that at best ecosystems absorb half that, I'm sure you'd agree with me that common sense would tell you that if you had any intent to stabilize emissions, you'd be wanting to see that curve come down to about here. Is that fair to say? You want to get down to 3.5 gigatons, and you want to get down there quick, not in 50 years, because of course ecosystems are starting to break down as well. And that just shows you very clearly that the IPCC has no intention of stabilizing climate change. And it's a really important point to make. It's the sort of challenge that we need to be making in meetings, putting your hands up and saying, look, we're on a path to suicide here. The writing's on the wall and we're not doing anything. Nicholas Stern gave his great presentation last November talking about how we can reduce some mitigate against climate change. And all his figures were to do with 550 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. We're at 383 parts per million right now. We know that we will be struggling if we stabilize at 450. We're at 383. We stable at 450. It's unlikely we will prevent runaway climate change. We would have to be stabilizing at about 400. And all his figures are at 550. And when I raised the question at the London School of Economics, where he was speaking, and I mentioned about Earth systems theory and the need to prevent other climate feedbacks accelerating the process, he said, oh, well, if you believe in Earth systems theory, that's quite another thing. We can talk about reducing emissions to 450 in a completely matter-of-fact way. Essentially, the Stern report commits us to catastrophic climate change. And he is deeply remiss, both as an economist and as a human being, for allowing that to pass through government. Well, how are we going to do this magical achievement of the seven wedges? Here's the wedge on biofuels, 24 billion million barrels a day. It'll require a land area the size of India, and not India with its mountains and desert areas. It'll need land space that is highly cultivatable land. Our best quality land will be required. Now, under current plantations, we still don't feed the world's population. 800,000 people go hungry every night. 2 billion people are on the breadline. And we already know about escalating food prices. So how on earth do we think that we can suddenly carve out a sixth of the world's most arable land and convert it into crops to feed our cars? And what a statement of arrogance that we think that feeding a billion automobiles is more important than feeding 800 million people. So we've got some serious question marks about the humanitarian nature of this. And Derek Jensen's written a book called Endgame. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that, about protesting. Great. Really worth a read. And one of the things he's very strong on is the fact that when you try to protest, you'll be crushed down, because power accumulates up the hierarchy. And it's considered to be, until the hierarchy turns, you are considered in some way to be subversive to society. And that is exactly what we need to do. We need to be able to challenge society in peaceful grassroots ways that actually cause enough momentum to pick up people continuously and challenge this. I think that well, Jim Hansen said, he's the head guy in head climatologist in NASA, said 2 years ago that we have less than 10 years to turn this around. My guess is we've probably got 7 years or less now. And after that point, the rest of the world will wake up. We'll have low carbon this, and we'll have zero carbon future for society, and we'll have all the transition towns you want, and it will almost make no difference. That's the tragedy. At that point, the positive feedbacks will feed on themselves. Just taking one example, the fact that we've now this year lost 1 million square kilometres of Arctic ice means you've got a million square kilometres less of reflective albedo pushing light and heat back out into space. Our reflective cap is that much more reduced, which means we now need to reduce greenhouse gases by so much more just to stabilise climate in the same way as we would have needed to do a year ago. Well, this isn't enormously important, but just to show you the very steep rise in bioethanol and biodiesel after the year 2000. And see how that already before then, we were producing 10 to 20 billion litres of biofuels a year, but that was mostly coming from Brazil. And this is the trajectory. If we the EU has a target of achieving 10% of our fuel consumption coming from biofuels by 2020, and the US is looking for 20% by 2020. Now, we have about 1% worldwide, and we're causing mayhem. If we double that to 2 or 3%, we're finished. And yet their trajectory, I mean, just look at it. It doesn't take a degree in, you know, climate science or ecology to work out that this is all about economics.
What was the percentage there? I didn't quite follow. Is that 10%?
By 2020.
Will be the
amount of biofuel contribution within our petrol. So it'll be bioethanol within petrol and biodiesel within diesel. So we want of our liquid fuels 10% to come from a bioenergy source. Okay. Well, I talked about in terms of the ecology, two very sensitive habitats are the Southeast Asian peat forest, swamp forest, and then the South American Amazon rainforest, both of which are really critical to keeping climate stable. Just looking at the figures or the intention there, we're looking to supply, for example, if I just start looking at rapeseed oil in the UK, you've seen the yellow fields of flowering rapeseed during our summer months, and people might convince you, well, that's really good, we're producing our own biofuels, we're not taking it from abroad. But what we're substituting in the process is usually animal feed. Animal feed was often grown on those lands, and now we get that animal feed very cheaply from countries like Argentina. And guess what they're doing? They're trashing their old growth forests to grow soya to constitute it into animal feed so they can send it to Europe. So even while we grow our own biofuels, we're still ending up trashing important ecosystems on the other side of the world. Ridiculous things like renewable obligation certificates, which are run by the as part of our renewable transport fuel obligation. We're trying to produce as much bioenergy as we can. Now the ROCs, renewable obligation certificates, are really for combined heat and power units for producing heat and electricity for homes and for offices. And what they're doing now is there is no legislation to stop palm oil coming in from Indonesia, which is the most sensitive area, and just quite simply burning it off for heat. And the ROCs actually encourage that. They say, well, if you buy that oil from Southeast Asia, we'll actually allow you renewable certificates against it. So encouraging businesses to do one of the most ecologically devastating practices. Just a comment about the amount of increase in palm oil. And the sort of land we'll need, these sort of maps are quite common in the biofuels arena. They're carving up large parts of the world and identifying it as land that's ideal for biofuels production. Not dissimilar to the old colonial maps that you might have seen 200 or 300 years ago. Yes, parts of that, yeah. Oh yes, just one might be worth noting here. Just look at the district, the Democratic Republic of Congo. Most of that is a lot of that is rainforest right now. They're quite happy to trash that and turn it into a biofuel mega production. And so here, this is the area where you can see. Well, I'm really looking at the equatorial areas now, the dark green areas around the centre. These are now already very important source sites for biofuel production. And the red spots are the consuming countries, and usually they've got targets driving the production of those biofuels in the south. Interesting developed and southern nation mix there. And look at Europe here, and America are bad enough, Australia, but look at Europe. We're taking in biofuels from every continent on the planet in order to feed our addiction to vehicles. Well, they tell us that biofuels doesn't destroy or damage climate. Well, you make your own mind up. Look at the smoke storms there in Kalimantan. And I've heard from people who've been there that they're there almost all the time. There's always smoke in the air. And look at the right-hand photo. This is from somebody who revisited an area in Argentina after being away for 2 years and found the forest completely removed and this little bit of scrub left, which is not viable on its own. And that's very often for soya, and it's that sort of soya that we use for animal feed or biofuels. And this is what's happening in Southeast Asia. Southeast Asia is critical as an ecosystem. Both the Amazon and the Southeast Asian swamplands formed probably at the end of the last ice age, maybe about 12,000 years ago. And what they did is, as carbon dioxide increased in the atmosphere, they served as repositories, pulling the carbon dioxide back in and depositing it underground, particularly in the case of swamp forest, pushing it underground in the form of peat, which can be up to 20 meters deep. Now, if you think about it, that's almost like a thermostat preventing us shooting out in terms of when carbon dioxide was increasing in the atmosphere, taking us into an interglacial, stopping us going higher into very high, much warmer temperatures. It's the Southeast Asian rainforest that we can thank for that. Now, what are we doing at the time when we have, you know, we desperately need to be absorbing this carbon? We're trashing these forests in order to burn it in our vehicles. And it's not just the loss of above ground biomass. It's also, when you drain the forests, you take the water out. You take the water out of the peat, and when peat becomes dry, it starts to oxidize, and it's the process of oxidation that releases the CO2. So what we desperately need to do, and we have vast areas of Indonesia and Malaysia that have been drained now, we really need to reflood those areas so the peat oxidizes no further, and of course replant as much as we can. Replant the swamp forest to whatever degree we can. This is the Amazon. I mean, it's heart-rending really to see what's happening there. Of course, when you do cut the forest down and you put plantations up, the plantations tend to have a drying effect on the soil, whereas the forests hold a lot of the moisture and rainwater in. So what happens is it changes the river flow. So what you have is vast areas flooded in certain times of years and then completely dead or reduced down to a trickle. So it's affecting the ecology of the wider Amazon itself. This is a picture of fires in the Mato Grosso area. Mato Grosso is large areas of that state are a plantation now, and many of the fires are burnt into a satellite intentionally in order to clear the plantation at the end of the season. But what happens is they can sometimes get out of control. And in some areas, they're allowed deliberately to get out of control because if new forest is consumed, they're allowed to then plant on the clear ground for soya. So it becomes almost like a vicious cycle. Well, we've been establishing agrofuel, we call it, in terms of the production of agricultural biofuels. Agrofuel policy has been developed for several years now. In 2005, a commission was put together, and look at the members of those commission. Four people from the automotive industry, automobile industry, three from oil companies, three from biofuel companies, biotech groups, timber industry, energy companies. The only research centres are those linked to the biotech industry themselves. Complete absence of rigorous research organisations, institutes or universities. Absence of NGOs who might have a mitigating force. Absence of any kind of representation from southern nations, despite the fact that all this affects southern nations. Somehow we don't need to consult them. There's something, you know, you can see the old colonial arrogance in this. Is that fair to say? And these are the sorts of corporate partnerships that you're seeing springing up. In agribusiness, you'll have heard of Cargill. Biotech companies, Monsanto, I'm sure you've heard of, and DuPont, Syngenta have up in the headlines as well. Oil companies, car manufacturers. These are the four big conglomerations that are coming together to form the broad biofuel corporate partnerships. Any one of those on their own would be pretty scary. And if you imagine the mass of wealth that they combine, we're talking about the wealth of many nations put together. But worse than many nations put together, because they have their fingers in government and vice versa. And that means it's almost unshakable. One of the things we need to talk about here is where we go from here. How do we start to make inroads? Well, it's not just the climate issues. The climate issues is a major humanitarian problem, because if it does trigger the sixth mass extinction, well, you know, in the words of James Lovelock, founder of the Gaia hypothesis in the late 60s, you know, we might be reduced to just, his words, a few breeding pairs in the North Pole by the end of the century. Now, I take that to be a few thousand people. But that's the kind of scenario if runaway climate change takes effect. Here we have farmsteads in Paraguay. What's happened here, and why you're seeing nothing growing there, is the biofuel corporations have started to come in on the land and seize that land. And they seize it in a number of ways. One of the classic ways is by spraying. So they have adjacent land, which they are legitimately spraying in terms of pesticides or whatever it might be for their biofuel crops. But then they extend the area, and the people finally get the hint and move off, sometimes with quite damaging effects. This is a protest action here in West Kalimantan, where 5 million indigenous people, it's intended, will be displaced as a result of the biofuels production there. The United Nations Forum on Indigenous Peoples says that 60 million people will be displaced worldwide as a result of biofuels production. And then you have to wonder, what happens with this displacement? Where do 60 million people go? Well, some will go into shanty towns, some will be taken into bonded labour and will be used on these agri-fuel productions, agricultural systems, under very difficult conditions. But many will actually have to retreat into virgin ecosystem. They'll have to go into forests and fell them to grow their own food. There's no other place for them to go. So whilst some biofuel corporations say that they don't themselves destroy rainforests, their activities cause the displacement that does. So some of the problems with what they're trying to do now is create sustainability standards and say, well, we can have sustainable biofuels. And this is how they go about it. The consultation all involves northern organizations, most of which are within the corporate sector, but there are some NGOs that are involved in that, non-government organizations, whether they're humanitarian groups or environmental groups, but nobody, no representation from the south. Their proposals address the micro impacts, like let's try to reduce emissions by 1% by, you know, maybe using a different type of fertilizer or perhaps a little lower aerial spraying, but they don't include the macro impacts, which is the destruction of ecosystems, which is likely to tip us into catastrophic climate change if we lose the Amazon or we lose Southeast Asian rainforests. So they don't address these macro impacts, and it's not just the destruction of those forests. Every year they're gone, you lose the sequestering capacity of those forests of further carbon. So you don't have the 50% that we're absorbing now. So these are very, you know, very serious impacts. Another macro impact is changing the rainfall patterns worldwide as a result of the loss of these ecosystems. And lastly, they're pushing through sustainability standards when there's still no blueprint that would offer at least an intellectual understanding of a guarantee. The blueprints aren't there because it's not possible to do it. You have to be able to handle displacement. You can't magic up this land from nowhere on a finite planet. So what's happened now is a number of NGOs have got together. Biofuel Watch has been, we have a number of partners now, and we've launched what we call a moratorium call. A moratorium is simply, it's a pause. It's almost like it's like trying to implement the precautionary principle. It's saying we know there are devastating effects, so let's call a timeout. And let's have 5 years where we study it in detail and see if it really is going to work. Ideally, you're right, we should call for a ban, but a moratorium gives us thinking space. And what we're calling for a moratorium on is incentives for agri-fuels, in other words, tax breaks, financial incentives to organisations to generate them. Of course, that shouldn't be happening. Imports of agri-fuels, because we really don't know where they're coming from. And some companies do this shop-front thing where they say it's come from here, come over and have a look, and it's bona fide and they're genuinely produced biofuels. And then they sell their bad biofuels, which come from rainforest, to somebody else. And the third area is agro-energy monocultures in the UK. In other words, things like vast monocultures of rapeseed oil that we talked about before because of the displacement impacts that they have. To give you one example, Germany produces 1% of its own biofuels for its vehicles, yet it uses 12% of its land to do so. It is at capacity. That's why they're pushing so hard to end set-aside. And now the regulations in the UK to end set-aside. We desperately need this land to produce biofuels, supposedly. So where do you think Germany is now going to be able to meet the other 9%, to meet its EU target of 10% of biofuels by 2020? It's all going to come from southern nations. Southern nations can't even feed themselves. Where is the land going to come from? So this is an environmental nightmare in the making. So just a conclusion then, there are broad areas that this is going to influence, and any one of these would be devastating for us, whether it knocks our food supply out because the Amazon goes into collapse and it affects the rainfall throughout, particularly through America, particularly if the Midwest grain belt doesn't get watered by the Amazon rains, America will cease to become a grain exporting country. And at that point, there will be no surpluses for international food aid. There will be no cheap grain anymore. And we will be struggling to find out where is our future food security going to come from. At just 1% penetration, we have to look at where the rest of the biofuel land is going to come from. The idea of expropriation of land, that this is land where people have rights to. Many, particularly indigenous people, have been in these forests and in these lands for millennia. And we feel that we have the right to just push them out and take hold of this land. This is a flagrant abuse of human rights. Massive acceleration of global warming, we said. And there is a calling for this demand that the EU behaves responsibly and then the US follows suit and behaves responsibly. So far, we have nearly 200 NGOs worldwide who've joined this moratorium call. But tragically, still some of the big NGOs are not joining. Greenpeace UK, Friends of the Earth Youth UK, Christian Aid, many of the large Worldwide Fund for Nature would never think of joining. They think biofuels are the best idea possible. We've got some serious problems with the large NGOs who think that they can somehow get into bed with business and somehow make the planet hang together. And it's a very serious problem. I think within 3 months, my hope is that Christian Aid and Friends of the Earth will come on board and will change their position. But it's taken a year of campaigning to get them on board, and they're not there yet. Yet many other Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth organisations around the world are on board, particularly where they represent Southern Nation issues. So we have a very interesting situation with our NGOs, our environmental NGOs in the UK, and it's also in the US, where somehow we seem to align ourselves with big corporates and don't recognise where we're actually too closely involved. So folks, just on a more cheerier note, some people might say, well, what is the solution to biofuels? What is the solution to our energy needs? Well, the only real solution is to recognise that the way we live our lifestyle right now is unsustainable, and we have to get into a sustainable position. The most intelligent response would be for us as human beings, as a global human race, to go through a managed 15-year recession, where we manage the reduction in consumption and emissions, and we build up a renewable energy infrastructure world globally. We give patent-free technology to the developed world and the scientific expertise to develop it. We write off all international debts, and we restructure our economy so it's not growth-driven. That would be the intelligent approach. Much easier to say than do. Now, given that that's sadly not going to happen, people are going to look and say, well, hold on, we still need to have our current energy consumption in a renewable form. Concentrating solar power or solar thermal energy, these are the vast disks, you might imagine, great big disks that focus light into a central point and can generate electricity. This is just one idea. There are many different ideas, but this one idea shows that for about 240, the small EU square, about 240 kilometres square, will provide all the electricity needs for Europe. The larger one, about 450 square kilometres, that side to side of concentrating solar panel dishes, would provide all the electricity worldwide. If we were to provide our entire energy needs, given that electricity is only about a fifth to a quarter of our use, you'd have to multiply that large square by four and put it around the world. Now, I'm showing you that picture not because I think we should do that, but just to show you that we have the technology, and we even have high-voltage direct current power lines that could take energy produced in the Sahara to London with something like only a 10 to 15% energy loss. And what's more, if you had a high-voltage direct current infrastructure around Europe, you could take geothermal energy from subarctic areas, you could take offshore wind from the areas with large coastline like the UK, and you could feed it all into this grid and provide all the energy we could ever need. I'm not saying we go down that route, but I'm saying common sense tells us that there are much more productive avenues to go down to generate vast quantities of renewable energy than biofuels. Thank you.